got you with the left, the left. You will fake, so I'm gon' got you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the lecturer, nigga, left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left. You will fake, so I'm gon' got you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the lecturer, nigga, left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
Son of a bitch. What's up, everybody? Hope you enjoyed your weekend. I got a jam-packed show today, so I'm not even going to tease it for you, but we're going to leave the show with some bad news here that I really don't want to talk about, but unfortunately I'm forced to talk about it. And the only tiny little bitty eensy-weensy tease I'll give you is that we got a bunch of Trump in the show, and we got Bernie in the show. So, in other words, like every other show in terms of covering those two. All right, let's go ahead and get started here. I want to try to squeeze in 15 today. So the other day, we covered a story about how there's a pretty big crackdown that came from YouTube. Now, some say it's YouTube's fault, some say it's not YouTube's fault. Really, they're responding to advertisers who decided, hey, we're just going to flee because we don't like where our ads are going. And it's based off of what I would call hit job articles, one from the Wall Street Journal, one from the Times of London, and I think some others have gotten in on the fun, where they had these really, really misleading articles that basically implied that all this neo-Nazi content and just explicitly, overtly hateful content on YouTube has ads. And big brands naturally said, I don't want Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and who else? There was Verizon, I think. Just a whole bunch of huge advertisers said, yeah, I don't want my brand associated with that, so we're pulling our ads. Now, the reality is, the YouTube algorithms were already set up where if you have a Nazi channel or if you're posting terrorist videos, you're not going to get monetized. 99.9% of the time, that doesn't happen. And the only time something slips through the cracks, it's likely because on some really hateful channel, they happen to post at one time or another a video that is actually not related to the really, you know, horrific, hateful content. So there's this non-problem that they blew up into a problem, and then YouTube said, well, that's nice. Now we're going to go ahead and crack down even more on so-called offensive or controversial content. And as a result of that, they took the policies which were already too strict, and they put them into hyperdrive. So I described this on the show in the last segment, but whenever I do a segment, remember, we do news and political commentary here. Whenever I do a segment describing something factual about what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS, for example, demonetized. Whenever I talk about Syria, demonetized. Whenever I talk about Iraq, Israel, Saudi Arabia, demonetized. Whenever I do any story that covers drug policy for you guys, demonetized. It doesn't matter what I say in the video. Just the fact that I'm discussing those topics, demonetized. Now, recently they also added to the list if you discuss race issues. Doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter. I could be discussing a story about how there was an overtly, you know, racist action taken against somebody at some school somewhere, and I could be coming out against it and saying this is wrong and they should fix that. Demonetized. They also, religion is another new one. Talk about religion, demonetized. So the problem is actually the opposite of what people are claiming the problem is. The problem with the YouTube algorithm and the ad system is not that too many ads are getting on hateful content. It's that not enough ads are getting on inoffensive content. So as a result of this, we are absolutely positively getting hammered. It's not just here at Secular Talk, but I've heard and been speaking with other pretty prominent YouTubers, and the hammer has been dropped on us. Now, what's weird is there are some other YouTubers in the same category, news and politics, who it hasn't affected. Or maybe it hasn't affected yet. I really don't know. Nobody really knows what's going on. YouTube is not being very open about this process. So They claim, maybe we're rolling out a new ad system, so it might be kind of glitchy or whatever for a while. But I can tell you based on what I know from the back end of my own YouTube channel and some of the YouTube personalities I've spoken to, we're talking YouTube apocalypse here. We're talking utter collapse and implosion of some of your favorite channels. So I don't know what's happening or what the answer is, but it's bad. And YouTube either needs to change their policies or fix this glitch, or I don't even know. Look, if I was them, here's how I would have handled it when there was advertisers calling saying, we're going to leave. I would have said, no, you're not, because this isn't a problem. Those articles are incorrect. They're just not true. We have, if anything, the opposite is the problem. We have inoffensive comment getting swept up with the offensive content and getting demonetized. And remember, YouTube, I always said, is uniquely free in the sense that there's a giant buffer. Google and YouTube talk to the advertisers. The content creators like myself never talk to the advertisers. So we kind of have this freedom to say whatever we want about any topic, and that's one of the reasons why it's become so popular is that people come here because it's particularly free. And you feel like you're getting something unfiltered, whereas you watch mainstream media and it's just corporate media. You can see the advertisers affecting it. Well, now YouTube is saying we're actually going to listen to these corporate advertisers, even though they're wrong about something, and pull ads from people. And as a result of that, I'm telling you, we're all hurting bad. And actually, again, that's not true that all of us are hurting bad. I've only spoken to one person outside of news and politics who's a YouTuber. Totally fine. They've had no effect in their revenue or anything like that. But probably 80% of the people, myself included, who do news and politics, it's the apocalypse, just an utter collapse. In fact, I want to go ahead and show you here. This is the line of our revenue and what happened in recent days. That, my friends, is what's called unsustainable. It just falls off a cliff. Just fell off a cliff. So with the new videos that they demonetized because they made the number of categories you could talk about limited now, even more, Secular Talk has 700 new demonetized videos. 700. We have about 10,000 on the channel total. 700 new demonetizations on top of the ones that were already demonetized. Wow. Furthermore, the ads, because of the crackdown, and because I don't know if Google specifically targeted news and politics channels or certain news and politics channels, the placement of the ads for the foreseeable future, they're just not there. They're not putting any ads. You can check. Go check now. You know, if you're watching, note the date of this video. Maybe it changes at some point. I hope it changes at some point. But go look. Go click on other Secular Talk videos. The overwhelming majority of you are not going to see ads. Almost, most videos, you're going to see nothing. So, again, what that means is there's an implosion happening here. So what I need now is your help. Now, we're going to have to – I'm in a corner. I have to do something, and this isn't even all I'm doing. I have to figure out something else to do along with it in terms of another revenue stream. But as of right now, the outlet that I have in short notice, just realizing the utter implosion, I need everybody, if you already use Amazon, you do me a solid. Use the Secular Talk Amazon link. So we do the affiliate program with Amazon, and what that means is if you shop on Amazon but you're shopping through our link, then we get like 5% to 7% thereabouts of your purchase, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So it's the same price for whatever you're buying, but it's just that 5% to 7% of the money comes to Secular Talk. I'm going to go ahead and I'll write the link on the screen. It's a little confusing. I think they make it confusing on purpose, because if it wasn't confusing on purpose, then I think a lot more people would use it, and they'd rather not give 5% to 7% to the small businesses. So I'll leave the writing on the screen here. Use that. If you already shop on Amazon, use it. There's no downside for you, and there's tremendous upsides for me. And I'll leave the writing on the screen. I'll leave the link in the video description box. Fuck, I'm going to put the link like 5 times in the video description box. Why? Because times are dire. So please, 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 I can't stress it enough, use that link. It's really important to me. And like I said, I guess there was a false sense of confidence about the business model that we have going here and that other YouTubers have going, where you just kind of assume that there's going to be a stable level of ad revenue as you do your stuff. Because, I mean, let's face it, not to brag or anything, but the views aren't going anywhere. The views are going to be there. So you would think a logical response is, well, the more views there are, the more ads there are, which means the more revenue for Secular Talk and for other YouTube channels that have a decent following. We didn't really take into account the fact that the advertisers or YouTube or both might just pull the rug out from underneath us because of the content we cover. So yeah, fuck you. Not interested in you. We're going to go put some more monetization on cat videos or makeup tutorials or any of that stuff, and we're just going to hang you out to dry on purpose. And again, look, maybe not. I don't know. You tell me. It is kind of convenient that this is the timing when it just became obvious that for better or worse, YouTube and new media and alternative outlets, independent media, seem to have like a really large effect on our politics. And, you know, people trust their sources that they find on YouTube a lot more than they trust shitty traditional outlets. And, oh, look at that. Lo and behold, looks like the establishment pulls the rug out from underneath us as soon as we, like, get that position. So you're going to have, it's not just me, it's going to be a lot of others relying more directly on you guys, the audience, for help moving forward. So as of right now, this is all I got for you. If you could please use this link, it would mean the world to me. But also expect very soon something else to be rolled out, because in order to keep it going, it's obvious that you can't just rely on YouTube as your main source of income anymore. We could still be housed on YouTube, but there's got to be other ways to make money to keep it going, because it's apparently unsustainable. And it was a fool's errand to just sit back and expect, yeah, I'll just keep making the content and then I'll keep getting, you know, justly compensated for the fruits of my labor. No, it turns out they could say, oh, no, you can still keep doing the same amount of work, but now watch your income implode. So I just wanted to give you guys a heads up about this and let you know there will be some changes coming. I wish they weren't, but, you know, you direct your ire at YouTube and at the advertisers, because that's the boat we're in right now. Okay. Sorry for the depression here, but it's got to bring it up. You know, got to talk about it. All right, next. We have some new financial disclosures for Trump's administration, and it's pretty incredible. So ABC News explains here. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner remain beneficiaries of a real estate and business empire worth up to $740 million, even as both hold senior roles at the White House. Let me just pause. There's so much wrong with that. The first thing that's wrong with it is nepotism. Like, you can't just, oh, hey, my son-in-law, my daughter, I am now decreeing you high positions at the White House. Again, imagine just for a second, imagine Hillary Clinton just decreed, Chelsea Clinton is now my top advisor. Everybody, including me, would be like, that's preposterous. There are people who are way more qualified than her. That's your daughter. You're just doing it because it's your daughter. That's not okay. It's not like you're putting the best interest of the country here. You're putting the best interest of your family first. And, you know, damn the consequences. Well, now you're going to put Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, you know, in senior positions. What do you mean? Why are you mad at me? It's just totally cool. I don't know what you're talking about. No, that's not cool. No, that's not cool at all. So nepotism is the first problem. Second problem is $740 million. Look, it's not like, hey, by definition, if you have a lot of money and you're in the White House, you are a bad person. No, it's just something of an indicator that shows where your allegiance is going to lie, who your allegiance will lie with. So Trump, for example, has massive debt to Wall Street and the big banks, nearly $1 billion worth. So, okay, my guess is he's going to be doing favors for them to get his own ass off the line. That's not very good now, is it? Now, he has massively rich family members, so I don't know, whose interests are they really going to be looking out for? Their own, their other rich buddies? That's much more likely than looking out for a random grandmother in Nebraska. Let's continue. The financial information on the president's daughter and son-in-law is among a trove of financial disclosure forms that confirm the astounding wealth of senior staff in the White House who have an estimated combined net worth of at least $12 billion. Damn, $12 billion. Ivanka Trump, who just this week became a federal employee as an assistant to the president, has yet to file her own financial disclosure information. Kushner is a senior advisor to Trump. Among the revelations on the 54-page disclosure form by Kushner is that his wife Ivanka continues to hold a stake in the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., at the same time that the Trump Organization rents the hotel's buildings from the federal government that now employs Ivanka. Isn't that fun? Trump's chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, formerly chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs, earned at least $48.3 million in income in 2016 and holds assets valued at $252 million and $611 million. Counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, and her husband, George Conway, disclosed assets that were worth between $10 million and $39.3 million when she began work at the White House at the start of Trump's term. And the financial information for Trump's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, gives some sense of his income from his work with media and other outfits tied to conservative causes. Bannon earned nearly $400,000 in consulting fees in 2016 from Breitbart News, Cambridge Analytica, a data mining firm, and the Government's Accountability Institute, a conservative research organization. Bannon also received $100,000 in income from conservative film production company Citizens United Productions, and his assets are valued at somewhere between $11.8 million and $53.8 million. So he's getting money directly from Citizens United. Yes, the same Citizens United that was involved in the case, which got more money in our politics. Oh, Steve Bannon, he's, you know, the Trump administration, drain the swamp. They're fighting for the people. And by that, I mean they're fighting for more money in politics, and they're financially tied to the exact group that got more money in our politics. This is a sick, sick joke. And guys, what we're looking at here is one of the richest, if not the richest, administration in American history. Don't talk to me about a swamp unless you're going to tell the truth, which is that they are draining the swamp in our mouths. He's Gary Cohn. You know, Jordan Sheridan tweeted about this the other day. He was going through all these in detail, going through the disclosures. They say, well, actually, Gary Cohn is underreporting. So Gary Cohn, the guy who was the president of Goldman Sachs. Not only is Trump appointing Goldman Sachs people, the president, he was like, ew, let's show that we are the worst swamp ever. Not just a swamp, we are the worst swamp ever, president of Goldman Sachs. So the president of Goldman Sachs, he took an exit bonus when he left Goldman Sachs. By the way, do you get an exit bonus? You leave your job, here's a couple $100,000. Of course not. But Goldman Sachs, weird, he gets an exit bonus, and what's the job he's going to next? Oh, he's going to be, a top administration official in the White House. Weird how that works. It's almost like they want to pay him money so that he does favors for them. Almost like that. It was over $250 million. He takes an exit bonus of over $250 million, and the disclosure doesn't even show all that money. And they're like, whoa, what's wrong here? I don't know what you're talking about. There's no problem. There's no problem. You think there's a problem because this criminal organization that got away with fraud on a massive scale gave me hundreds of millions of dollars and then I'm going to the White House and I'm going to directly control economic policy? I don't know what you're talking about. You've been had. You've been took. That's what this is. You've been bamboozled. Trump is a con artist who got into the White House. Now, that's not saying Hillary Clinton is good because she's not. But let's just accept the reality of what it is right now. This is an administration that is the quintessential swamp. This is the perfect swamp. This is the epitome of a swamp. It doesn't get swampier than this. And these disclosures show that this is roughly the 917th piece of evidence pointing in that direction. Okay. Next. Okay. President Trump did something that might be a first for a sitting U.S. president. Listen to this. A U.S. judge on Friday approved a $25 million settlement to resolve a class action lawsuit that claimed fraud against President Donald Trump and his Trump University real estate seminars. The ruling from U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel in San Diego concluded a lengthy and contentious lawsuit that played a prominent role in the presidential campaign last year. The Trump University students, who paid as much as $35,000 for the seminars, $35,000, claimed they were lured by false promises that they would learn Trump's investing secrets from his hand-picked instructors. Now, they go on to say, hey, they weren't hand-picked instructors. So, fraud. Okay, that wasn't the biggest problem. That's like the least of their problems. I read in detail the claims made against Trump in this lawsuit, and this has been going on for a long time, by the way. One of the things they said is that he'd be there, and he'd take a picture with the students. They literally had a cardboard cutout of him there, and the people would take a picture with a cardboard cutout of him. Furthermore, he hired known con artists, people who had literally gone to jail for that. They were scammers. He hired them. They also did classic scam techniques, one of them known as upselling. So people come in, they pay the money to go to the original class. When they're in the original class, what you say in the original class is, oh, well, look, we're going to give you a little bit here, but if you buy the next package up, well, then you really get the secrets. And then, you know, some people would buy that, and then you upsell again. Well, look, you know, hey, we're going to give you a little bit more, but if you really want the good stuff, give us thousands of dollars more. They also specifically targeted people who they thought were easy targets. If there was, like, somebody who's middle-aged or younger and they seem with it, they kind of, like, let them slide and we don't really want them as part of this. But if there's somebody who's elderly, if there's somebody who's disabled, you spend extra time on them to try to get more of their money. So you go through the details of this, and it is just horrific. And it's also goofy. Like, they would play the theme song to The Apprentice at the beginning of every session, because it was when he was on The Apprentice, or when he was about to be, or something. I don't know the exact time frame here, but that's what they did. They'd play that before the classes, as if it's like you're in a third world nation, and you're saluting the dictator. Like, we will listen to his music first. Like, what the? So, yeah, he committed fraud. He didn't give them anything. There was nothing here. They're investing secrets, and it's going to be great. It's going to be tremendous. And by the way, he also called it a university, and it just wasn't a university. Like, in order to call something a university, you can't just do that. It's like if I buy an office or something and say, Kyle's Brain Surgical Center. Are you just legally allowed to do it? No, I'm not. I don't know how to fucking do brain surgery. I can't just fucking call it that. That's crazy. That's fraud. You can't. No, it's my brain surgical center. What do you mean? What's the problem? I have the freedom to do that. No, you don't. There's regulations that say you need a license, you need approval. And New York State was like, you can't just fucking call this a university. It's not a university at all. So, you know, there's a million examples of how this was fraud. And then as I was reading through the article yesterday, it hit me, as I'm sure it's hit many people listening right now. Like, we have a president of the United States who committed fraud. He committed fraud. Like, that's what it is. He committed fraud. So it's almost, like, literal. You say he's a con artist, he's a scam artist. That's what he is. So it's not like we say it and we almost feel like it's a side comment, a figure of speech. Like, well, oh, yeah, I don't know. It almost means, like, he's a good bullshitter. It's not just a good bullshitter. Like, he just settled a lawsuit because he committed fraud. That's crazy, man. I think this may be a first for U.S. presidents. By the way, it's not like the others are lovely. As Noam Chomsky says, every post-war, World War II, I think, American president would be hanged if the Nuremberg trials were upheld. So they violate international law like nobody's business. They're killing innocent civilians left and right, as is Trump. But I think this fraud angle is like a new thing, uniquely slimy, at least in this respect. And he paid out $25 million to settle the suit. Wild. Okay. Next.
We're going to talk about Neil Gorsuch.
So Joe Donnelly became the third Democratic senator to announce that he's voting for Neil Gorsuch to be on the Supreme Court. That's just peachy. He's voting yes along with Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Manchin, two other blue dog corporate Democrats. So what bugs me about this story more than anything else is that these are the politicians that the establishment press loves. So they always talk about the Joe Manchins as if this is the future of the Democratic Party. They need to all be more like Joe Manchin if they want to be viable. In other words, the Democrats always need to run to the right. That's what they say. Like, well, you got to be like a reasonable centrist, and you got to like, you know, negotiate and compromise. And in order to do that, you need to have Democrats who like vote all the time with the Republicans. So they have nothing but fawning adoration for their beloved faux centrists, their blue dogs who are just Republican light. And they think they're the most reasonable people on the planet, and they think Bernie Sanders, who actually represents the people and what they want according to the polls, they think Bernie is the most unreasonable person on the planet. So see how true their theory is. If they're making the claim, well, these guys are the most reasonable, and these guys are the future of the Democratic Party. They got to be more right-wing. They got to be all blue dogs. That's what we need. Well, let's see how the people really feel about them. So watch Lindsey Graham here at a town hall. This is in South Carolina, of all places. Let's see how they feel about Judge Neil Gorsuch.
I'm going to vote for Judge Gorsuch. I think he's a highly qualified man.
South Carolina town hall. South Carolina, deep in red country. You know, it turns out that when you're, you want to be on the Supreme Court, but your voting record as a judge is completely with management and the corporations and against labor, it turns out even Republicans and conservatives don't like you very much. We're talking about a guy who almost always votes with corporations over workers. We're talking about a guy who is a theocrat. He loves meshing together church and state as long as we're talking about Christianity. We're talking about a guy who says, under no circumstances is physician-assisted suicide okay. Terminal cancer, doesn't matter. He wrote a book against it. We're talking about a guy who praises Scalia till no end. He's baby Scalia. In deep red South Carolina, when a Republican says, I'm going to vote for this guy, boos. But according to the establishment media, you need reasonable centrist Democrats, blue dogs like Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp. That's the future of the Democratic Party. Except the people say, hell no. Hell no. Hell no. Man, they've been wrong about everything, and they still smugly make the same predictions and double down. Like, you would think when the Democrats ran the ultimate corporate insider candidate, the ultimate establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton, and then we got our asses handed to us on a silver platter, and you would think that when Republicans hold the presidency, the Senate, the House, most state legislatures, and most governorships, you would think that they would say, you know what, maybe that was the wrong move. Instead, they double down. They say, no, the problem is they weren't far right enough, and we need to go further right, and we need to have, like, Joe Manchin. And by the way, look, think about how dumb they are as individuals. Like, they think because they're from red states and Trump won those states, they're like, well, obviously they're going to support Trump and everything he does, and we need to just fall in line and do what Trump wants us to do because that's our only chance to win re-election. They're going to get wiped out. They're going to get wiped out because people – Trump has a 35% approval rating right now. And people aren't just drones. That's why you have in South Carolina town hall people booing Judge Gorsuch because they know enough about him to say, I don't like that guy. So they're doing the exact thing. They're trying to save their own ass, and that's why they're voting for Gorsuch. But that's the exact opposite thing that they should do. They should vote against him and take a stand and say, look, man, he doesn't look out for the workers. That would actually get them reelected. That would get them sympathy. But no, they're going to do the wrong thing, thinking it saves their ass, so they care more about their ass than they do the country, But ironically, if they did the right thing by the country, it would actually save their ass. So the corporate Democrats, proven failures over and over. Look at Allison Lundgren Grimes. This is the best example of it. Ran against Mitch McConnell when he was the least liked senator in the country. He still is, by the way. He still is the most disliked senator in the country. But Allison Lundgren Grimes, a Democrat, couldn't beat him. Why? She ran as Republican-like. She did ads holding guns. She wouldn't even say she voted for Obama when she was asked that in a press conference. So let me get this straight. You're going to run as a Democrat, but you're going to hold guns and do these goofy, folksy ads trying to be Republican, and you're not even going to say you voted for the Democratic president. And on every issue, like, I'm just like Mitch, except maybe a little bit better. People go, no, I'd rather have the original thing. So she lost when she had the most winnable race ever. And again, the corporate Democrats and the Blue Dog Democrats say, no, we need to do even more of that strategy. They never learn. They never, ever learn. Okay. All right, last story before we take our first break. Let's go to Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell spoke to Chuck Todd about the Supreme Court, and Mitch broke the bullshit meter here. He even managed to make Chuck Todd look decent, which is hard to do because Chuck Todd is the human embodiment of oatmeal.
Let's move to the Supreme Court. There is clearly a debate and a fight about how Supreme Court justices are confirmed, how it was handled. Do you have any regrets on how you treated Merrick Garland last year?
No, the tradition had been not to confirm vacancies created in the middle of a presidential year. You'd have to go back to 80 years to find the last time that happened. You go back to 1880s to find the last time it happened. Before that, everyone knew, including President Obama's former White House counsel, that if the shoe had been on the other foot, they wouldn't have filled a Republican president's vacancy in the middle of a Supreme Court, in the middle of a presidential election. So that clearly wasn't going to happen, even if the roles had been reversed.
Well, I understand that, but why not? If that was the rationale, that's a rationale to vote against his confirmation. Why not put him up for a vote?
Really?
Well, I mean, why
really?
Isn't that a, I mean, I'm just, that is a, look, any senator can have a rationale not to vote for a confirmation. Why not put Merrick Garland on the floor, and if the rationale is, you know what, too close to an election, then vote no.
Look, we litigated that last year. The American people decided they wanted Donald Trump to make the nomination, not Hillary Clinton. And what's before us now, Chuck, is not what happened last year, but the qualifications of Neil Gorsuch, unanimously well qualified by the American Bar Association. 99% of the time in the majority, 97% of his opinions were unanimous. Only one time reversed by the Supreme Court. There's no rational basis, no principled reason for voting against Neil Gorsuch, and that's what's before the Senate this week.
You say it's been litigated last year, the Maryland situation. For a lot of Senate Democrats, they're not done litigating this, including someone like Tom Carper, a Democratic senator who is not comfortable with the idea of filibustering, but believes Merrick Garland was mistreated. Again, what was wrong with allowing Merrick Garland to have an up or down vote?
I already told you. You don't fill Supreme Court vacancies in the middle of a presidential election. That's what Joe Biden said back in 1992, and he's
the
chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We knew exactly.
Should that be the policy going forward? Are you prepared to pass a resolution that says, in election years, any Supreme Court vacancy and have it to be the sense of a Senate resolution that say no Supreme Court nominations will be considered in any even-numbered year? Is that where we're headed?
Chuck, with all due respect, that's an absurd question.
Oh, that's hilarious. Chuck Todd just asked a question based on what Mitch McConnell did. And he's like, oh, so is that the standard you want to do? Do you want to do that going forward? Have a rule that says, hey, no confirmations in an election year. And he's like, yeah, that's an absurd question. So you're calling what you did absurd then. He's just restating what you did. He's like, okay, let me reiterate what you did, and do you think that's a good idea? How absurd. If it's absurd, you're calling yourself absurd because, Mitch, that's what you did. That's unbelievable. No, I want to watch that clip like 1,000 times over because it's like he's incapable of self-criticism and criticizing his own party. So he's like, Chuck Todd just asked the simplest question ever, the most straightforward question ever. Mitch McConnell's like, you don't approve in election years. That's what happens. And Chuck Todd's like, okay, so you're saying we shouldn't approve in election years. He's like, that's absurd. You just said it. That's what you did. Unbelievable. Unfucking believable. Okay. So let's go through some of the other points. He says, the tradition is you don't confirm in the middle of a presidential year. Totally made it up. Because not only is that not true, he also gave two examples when it wasn't true. And by the way, the examples he gave are probably the only examples there ever were. So the only times where somebody came up for the Supreme Court in an election year, they had put somebody on the court. So that's just a totally made – he calls it a tradition. It's totally made up. You just made it up right now. And then when Chuck Todd asks you if you really want that to be tradition, you go, that's absurd. Unbelievable. Logic is not a thing to Mitch McConnell. And then Chuck Todd points out, dude, there wasn't even a hearing on Garland. There wasn't even a hearing. So now all the Republicans are, approve Gorsuch and do it right now, right now. Meanwhile, you didn't even have a hearing. It's not like you had a hearing on Merrick Garland and then you guys voted him down. You didn't even have a hearing. That's unbelievable. And then he says the American people decided they wanted Trump to be the one to fill that vacancy. Actually, no, Mitch. They decided they wanted Obama to fill that vacancy because Obama had a year left in office to fill that vacancy. He wasn't elected for a three-year term his second time around. He was elected for 4 years. So 3 years in, Scalia dies. He's got a year to fill it, and you say, no, under no circumstances ever will that ever happen. So they picked Obama to fill it, and you just made up that they picked Trump to fill it. They had picked Obama because he's elected for, say it with me, 4 years. They broke a record, by the way. They either doubled or tripled it. He's like, this is common. I don't know what you're talking about. No, they broke the record for not filling a Supreme Court vacancy. And he acts like that's the tradition. What do you mean? The tradition is breaking a record. And then finally he says, there's no principled reason to vote against Gorsuch. Excuse you? The guy wrote a whole book saying physician-assisted suicide under all circumstances is wrong and not okay and illegal and unconstitutional. I think if somebody has terminal cancer or some incredibly painful illness, they should be able to end their life peacefully with their family around them and go in a way that's not going to be excruciating. He said, no, I want to make that decision for you. There's a principled reason right there, policy. How about the case with the trucker who would have frozen to death, but he disobeyed his managers and then got fired? Gorsuch was the only person to side with the company over the worker. That seems like principled reason. It's a policy reason. How about Hobby Lobby? The fact that he thinks it's okay for business owners to tell their employees what they can and can't put in their body and what can and can't be in their health insurance. Should they be able to say, hey, I don't believe in vaccines, so you shouldn't have them? No, hell no. Tell them to piss off. So he believes in theocracy. He believes in a really backwards, primitive social belief system. The guy sides with management over labor almost all the time. So there's only principled reasons to vote against Gorsuch. But no, he's such a bullshitter, I can't take it. I don't know how anybody takes these people seriously. He's screwing you over and over. By the way, Mitch McConnell, he took $250,000 from internet service providers and just voted to gut your internet privacy protections. So this guy, they are against you in a way that is unparalleled. I mean, they don't care about you at all. Their picks are actively against you. Their voting records are 100% against you. So you should know that moving forward and act accordingly. Let's take a break. When we come back, CNN article on Bernie Sanders, and then somebody's challenging Ted Cruz. Stay right there, y'all.
Bye. mind in the car with the puppets and trunk. Don't ever lie me, you know it's the pump. Bring it out of good green bullets and blood. Get a pip tight, girl, say I'm the main. Ice on the wrist with the ice in the chain. Ride through the hood, yeah, I'm dripping the grain. And I'm sipping the same while I'm changing the lane. I feel tight cause I'm choking the green. Bitch, I messed up cause I'm urgent to leave. Mess up with a D-boy, ride the big toy. Switch your man, gal, wanna get on the team. She gotta give it up when she get in my car. I ain't dead there, but I know I'm the star. Cause when I'm in the club, I be back in the bar. Yeah. In the VIP bar, and behind the bar.
Yeah.
Here for you. Bernie Sanders criticizes Clinton campaign, Democrats at Boston rally. Oh boy. So the response to this from the Clintonites on Twitter was, woo doggy. Man, they were not happy about this one, but let's see if you can find anything objectionable. They say Bernie Sanders criticized Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign in Boston Friday night at a progressive rally alongside Senator Elizabeth Warren, saying the Democratic nominee's loss revealed the need for the fundamental restructuring of the Democratic Party. The Vermont senator also said some Democrats believe the voters who backed President Donald Trump are racists, xenophobes, and deplorables, a word Clinton famously used. I do not agree, he said. All right, let me pause. Yeah, so far I think he's 95% correct. So the only minor point of disagreement, which I think if I brought up Bernie would agree with, is that Sure, you have some people who are TFG, some people who are deplorables, who they voted for Trump because he said certain things that were bigoted and xenophobic, like, for example, ban all Muslims from coming into the country, kick out all undocumented immigrants, use nationwide stop and frisk, which overwhelmingly disproportionately cracks down on minority communities and has over a 98% failure rate. So some people, yeah, they supported him for that reason. And it wasn't really about the economic stuff. But Bernie's largely correct that, you know, I would guess probably most of the Trump voters, they more heard his stuff on being anti-establishment and talking about being against outsourcing jobs and doing an infrastructure project and rebuilding the country and making America great again, tremendous. They heard that and they said, oh, that's like economically populist, and I think he's going to be better for working people than Hillary. Now, turns out Trump, of course, is a disaster for working people. He's appointed four or more Goldman Sachs people. He's outsourced his own jobs. He's raised taxes on the middle class. He's done all these things since he's been in power that show that's not the case. But in terms of how he campaigned, I think a lot of people were duped by the rhetoric and they thought he was more populist. So Bernie's just pointing that out. And he's also, look, there's a deeper point here, which is you can't expect to win these people over simply by saying, you know, you're racist, you're bigoted, you're sexist, you're deplorable. Again, some of them are that, but they're too far gone anyway. You have to try to get the people who you need who voted for Obama twice. That's who you need. You need the people who actually care more about the economics. And if you're not going to get them unless you talk about economics and serious issues that matter to them. All right, let's continue. Quote, it wasn't that Donald Trump won the election. It was that the Democratic Party lost the election, Sanders said. He ran through Democratic losses in recent years, checking off the Republican-controlled House, Senate, governor's offices, and state legislatures, before saying that Republicans are a right-wing extremist party who has an agenda that most Americans soundly and roundly disagree with. How in God's name do they win elections, Sanders said. And the reason is, in my view, that the time is long overdue for fundamental restructuring of the Democratic Party. We need a Democratic Party which is not the party of the liberal elite, but a party of the working class of this country. We need a party which is a grassroots party, a party where candidates are talking to working people, not spending their time raising money from the wealthy and the powerful. Sanders' comments came at a rally organized by his Our Revolution group, as well as several local left-wing organizations. Warren was not beside Sanders when he took the shots at Clinton's campaign and Democrats, and the Massachusetts senator and fellow 2020 Democratic prospect did not address those remarks on stage. But the event was meant to be much more of a progressive pep rally than a rehash of the 2016 campaign. I see nothing wrong with what he said. Let's continue here. Both Sanders and Warren touted proposals to make college affordable and to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and both repeatedly lambasted Trump's presidency. Sanders also touted his Medicare for All healthcare proposal, which he said he will introduce as legislation within the next month. Quote, on every major point facing this country, the American people do not believe in a right-wing agenda. They believe in a progressive agenda. We've got to take that agenda to the people. So think about that, man. They say, hey, here's the problem with the Democratic Party, and here is my constructive response. We need to focus on and talk about endlessly making the minimum wage a living wage. We need to focus on and push Medicare for All. We need to be issues-based, and we need to fight for the people. We need to be a grassroots party. And I'm telling you, people are mad at him for what he said. The Clintonites, with raising holy hell, with the fury of a thousand demons. One of the things that I saw is they kept calling him racist, Bernie. What? They said, oh, yeah, he moved from diverse New York to lily white Vermont. That's a quote, lily white Vermont. He marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And they literally said in one of the tweets, don't bring up that he marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Why? He's been fighting for civil rights since the literal civil rights movement. That's not relevant. That's exactly relevant. That is exactly relevant. So they're just smearing him as a result of this. And who can disagree? If the Democrats lose to a candidate who had a 60% unfavorability rating the day he won, 60%, how can you argue that the Democrats didn't lose that election? That was a layup election, and they blew it. the guy they were running against is a reality TV star buffoon with a dead ferret on his head who said, I grab him by the pussy, I don't even wait. And he beat you. So, yeah, definitely look in the mirror and go, well, what did we do wrong that we lost to this monster? And what do they want? Deflect. We did nothing wrong. It's racism. It's sexism. It's the deplorables in the country that did it for us. And Russia, of course. Bernie saying, how about you stop deflecting and how about you stop being a corporate sellout party and you focus on issues that matter to people like a living wage, like Medicare for all, and then you'll win if you're actually a grassroots party. And they're responding, no, we will not do that and we will stay in power. Well, we're here to kick you out. JusticeDemocrats.com. Go read our platform if you haven't to see what we're about. We're running candidates, guys. We're running candidates, regular people, working people. They take no corporate money, no PAC money, and they fight for the people. They're vetted in accordance with that platform. Go read about it and sign your name in support of the movement. We need you. And while you're at it, sign the petition where H.R. 676 is John Conyers' bill for Medicare for All. It's up right now. But you have over 100 Democrats who haven't co-sponsored it and haven't agreed to vote for it. You have 75 or 80 or so who said, okay, we're going to vote for it. So far, we flipped 10 people to be for it. You flipped 10 people because of the pressure you put on, the phone calls you're making to your congressman, and the fact that you're signing this petition. Some of the ones who flipped literally cited the petition. John Conyers was tweeting a thank you to the National Nurses United, the Nurses Union, who was part of this, brand new Congress, and Justice Democrats. He was thanking Justice Democrats in a tweet. Thank you for the pressure. It's working. So go do it. Go do it. Go call your congressman and say, we want you better sign on for Medicare for All, or we're going to primary you, and we're going to beat you. We're going to vote you out. I'm not going to vote for you if you don't vote for Medicare for All, if you don't co-sponsor it. Go do it. Go do it. Call your congressman. Sign that petition. Let's get it done, man. They're not going to listen to us unless we force them to. So we're going to force them to. Okay, next. There's an interesting story coming out of Texas about a challenger to one of the worst politicians in America. I think some of you are familiar with him. CBS News explains here, the Democrat gunning to unseat Senator Ted Cruz in Texas is ripping a page straight out of the playbook of Senator Bernie Sanders, framing himself as an outsider who wants to harness the grassroots and eradicate the corrupting scourge of money in politics. Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke, a mop-haired 44-year-old El Paso native first elected to the House in 2012, embarked on a four-city tour of Texas on Friday to launch his underdog campaign against Cruz, who is up for re-election next year. O'Rourke, who once played in a rock band and lived in Brooklyn, plans to take on Cruz directly on the issue of money in politics. Cruz raised nearly $90 million from super PACs during his 2016 presidential campaign, with $6 million going to a single analytics firm. O'Rourke has pledged not to take PAC money from wealthy donors. How about that? Instead, focusing on grassroots small-dollar fundraising. O'Rourke isn't the only Democrat with an eye on Cruz's Senate seat. Representative Joaquin Castro, a Democrat whose district includes San Antonio, may also throw his hat in the ring. If he does, he'll benefit from deep connections with national Democrats who could provide key support in the primary. Castro has been busy with the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. presidential campaign and has said he will decide by the end of April whether to jump into the race. So let me explain to you exactly what's happening here. You have somebody who's a long shot who's saying, look, in really conservative Texas, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. I'm going to run against Ted Cruz. I'm going to run as a populist Democrat. That is the only hope and the only chance the Democrats have of winning, running a populist candidate. So it's a long shot, but understand, it's only a long shot right now because people haven't heard of him. Once they start hearing of him, oh, they would flee quickly from Ted Cruz. Remember, Ted Cruz is one of the slimiest, smarmiest mofos out there. He really is. I mean, he was taking money from Goldman Sachs, raising money from Wall Street when, you know, a month earlier in the campaign, he would rip Wall Street and be like, give me the money, Just a slimy, greasy politician through and through. He has a horrible voting record. When he was the Attorney General in Texas, he tried to keep dildos illegal, try to resurrect some law that had dildos illegal. He is a total sellout mixed with genuine, backwards, Christian fundamentalist theocracy. He's one of the worst there is. He's even worse than Trump, which is just, woo, because he's, you know, Trump at least has the upside of every now and then he'll sprinkle in some populist rhetoric. Ted Cruz is just for TPP, you know, and but every bit as draconian as Trump in every other respect. So, my goodness, he's definitely beatable with a populist leftist, populist. So what's going to happen? The Democrats will likely throw a wrench in the plans, prop up Joaquin Castro, who has some national recognition, fund him with big money, give him support, and try to, you know, snub O'Rourke here, and then Joaquin Castro would go on to lose to Ted Cruz. That's what would happen. So yet again, we have another example of the exact opposite scenario that the establishment Democrats and the corporate Democrats think happens. They love to blame, oh, Bernie bros, Bernie Sanders supporters, yeah, ruined the election for us and gave us Donald Trump. No, that's you. You ruined the election for us and gave us Donald Trump when you propped up and backed the weaker candidate, Hillary Clinton, when all the evidence showed she was the weaker candidate against Trump. So you're the problem here. Now, the same thing will happen here. If Joaquin Castro gets in, they'll prop him up and they'll support him. And then he will beat O'Rourke in a primary because he has all the big money flowing in. And then he'll lose to Cruz, and then they'll turn around and say, yeah, the O'Rourke supporters ruined it for us. No, again, you ruined it if you put Castro in the first place because you're going to split the vote of the base, prop up the weaker candidate with the big money, and then lose to Ted Cruz. So you'd rather have Ted Cruz win than have a real populist leftist in there. You're the problem. It ain't us. We keep giving you the path to victory, and you keep spitting in our eye. JusticeDemocrats.com. Go there right now. That's what we need. We need a populist leftist movement, no corporate money, no PAC money. They fight for the people over and over again and on the issues that the American people agree with. And what we have here is O'Rourke, a guy who's a populist Democrat who says, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring here. And he actually has a chance if Castro and the corporate Democrats don't screw it up. Okay, next. Go to Tom Perez. DNC head Tom Perez gave a speech in New Jersey that's getting a lot of press. Let's take a look at the portion here that has everybody going wild. Support H.R. 676. It's the Medicare for All bill that Representative John Conyers has put forward because we want to make this country, like all the other modern countries when it comes to health care, cover everybody for a better price. We don't want you to go bankrupt because of medical bills. Did he say that? Oh, he didn't say that part. That's weird. So everybody's like, oh my God, oh, he said the Republicans don't give a shit about people when it comes to health care. Oh, you said this is the same kind of vacuous nonsense that drives me nuts. We will resist. We're going to resist. Resistance is good and resistance is key. And Vladimir Putin is bad.
I'm for good things and I'm against bad things, and we're going to lead with our values, and then we got to, they don't care about people. They don't care. They don't give a shit about people. His health care bill is bad.
I understand that you think their health care bill is bad. Debbie Wasserman Schultz think their health care bill is bad. You know what? You're right about that. But what are you going to do? What are you going to fight for? We resist. It's not enough. That's not enough. People go, that's nice. So you're against the utter implosion of our health care system. How progressive. You're against something that's a $600 billion tax cut to the top 1%. You're against something that would make 53 million people uninsured. You're against something that guts Medicaid $880 billion. You're against something that raises the uninsured rate from 10% to 19%. That's easy. But what are you defending? You're defending Obamacare, 28 million people uninsured. That's what it's going to be, 28 million people under Obamacare. You're defending a system that still has medical bankruptcies. Why are you defending that system? You're defending rising premiums. Why are you defending that? It would be one thing if you defend it and say, but here's the end goal, Medicare for all. You don't even do that. See, that's the problem. People, they look at you like you're full of shit because you're full of shit. It's so easy. I'm against this. I'm against bad things. I'm against things that are really bad. Okay, and be specific. Don't give me this bullshit. He does go on to his credit to go, healthcare is a right, not a privilege. But then he doesn't go on to say, we support Medicare for All, H.R. 676. Say it. But they're not going to say it because they don't believe it, because even in the House, over 100 Democrats don't support Medicare for All. It's up right now, guys. They can sign on to the bill right now. Over 100 don't support it. Only about 80 support it. Now, Justice Democrats and the National Nurses Union, National Nurses United, and brand new Congress, we, meaning you guys, flipped 10 Congress people because of the pressure you put on them in the petition that you signed. But we need more. If over 100 Democrats are still not supporting Medicare for All when it's up right now, then spare me your fucking shitty, we're up for good things and against bad things, and resistance is good and Putin's bad, and yeah, just vague platitudes and cliches. You're doing the same Hillary Clinton trick that, you know, screwed her over, because it was clear all she had was platitudes and cliches. She didn't have hardcore policy substance to make people's lives better. So they went, that smells like bullshit, I'm leaving. So give me a break, man. As he stacks the DNC with Hillary Clinton staffers, so the people who just lost to Trump, he's like, great, let me all give you all a job in the DNC. This is the last people you should hire. They just proved they can't even beat Trump, which was a layup election. He's like, let me hire you to be in the DNC. As you're doing that, you're out there, resist, we will resist by hiring the people who suck at it and don't know how to do it and lost him in the first place. And again, that gets headlines. The Republican health care plan is bad, and they don't give a shit about people. Wow, Tom, thanks for catching up to what we fucking knew in the year 1980. Wonderful. Tell me what you're for. I don't care what you're against. It's easy and obvious. Oh, yeah, they're bad. Great. What are you for? Medicare for all. Say it. You're not going to say it. Say end the seven wars right now. Bring home the troops. Are you going to say that? Are you going to be the anti-war party? You're not going to say it. Even when Trump increases military spending $54 billion, even when he increases drone strikes 432%, even when he adds 1,000 ground troops to Syria, even when he looks like he's going to increase in Afghanistan too, are the Democrats saying, this is outrageous. Should we not add $54 billion to the military, we should cut way more. We should cut spending at least 35%. We had a military-industrial complex. Over 50% of your discretionary budget goes to the military. The Democrats aren't saying anything about that. They're not opposing Trump on the military. They're not opposing him on things that actually matter and pushing for other policy goals or correcting the direction of the country. They're not doing it. Don't talk about that. Don't even talk about his deregulation. Don't talk about the coal polluting the waterways. Don't talk about the fact he raised tax on the middle class. Don't talk about the fact he's appointing Goldman Sachs, because when we're in there, we kind of want to do that too. JusticeDemocrats.com. No more of this garbage, this corporate democratic nonsense. Did you know Tom Perez supports TPP? The head of the DNC, when a populist right candidate won the election, now the head of the DNC is a supporter of TPP. It's like a comedy sketch where we were watching everything go wrong. We have the antidote to defeat the monstrous guy on the right, and they just refuse to listen. JusticeDemocrats.com. Go there right now. Okay. Next. All right, got another clip for you. Chris Wallace of Fox News spoke to the EPA head, Scott Pruitt, and this guy proved yet again that he has no clue what he's talking about.
You had a famous exchange a couple of months ago, or actually last month, that I'd like to play right now. Do you believe that it's been proven that CO2 is the primary control knob for climate? Do you believe that? No, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see. Mr. Pruitt, there are all kinds of studies that contradict you. The UN's panel on climate change says it is at least 95% more than half the temperature increase since the mid-20th century is due to human activities. NOAA, that's our own National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says there's more carbon dioxide now than in the last 400,000 years, and NOAA says 2015 and 2016 are the two hottest years on record. Mr. Pruitt, are we supposed to believe that that's all a coincidence?
No, look, Chris, I've said through the process, in my confirmation process, individually with senators as well, that there's a warming trend. The climate is changing, and human activity contributes to that change in some measure. The real issue is how much we contribute to it and measuring that with precision. But then also, what is the process as far as response? What can we do about it? The tools in the toolbox to address the CO2 issue. And you can't just simply, from the EPA perspective, make that up. You can't do what the president did previously with the Clean Power Plan, President Obama and his administration, to simply reimagine authority. That's why we have a U.S. Supreme Court stay against the Clean Power Plan. That's why President Trump is dealing with that regulatory overreach and charting a new path forward to deal with these issues within the framework of the Clean Air Act.
Sir, you're kind of sugarcoating what you said. You said there, I would not agree that carbon CO2 is a primary contributor to global warming. And the question I have is, what if you're wrong? What if, in fact, the Earth is warming? What if it is causing dramatic climate change and that we as humans, through carbon emissions, are contributing to it? Simple question. What if you're wrong?
See, look, let me say to you, CO2 contributes to greenhouse gas. It has a greenhouse gas effect and global warming, as methane does, and other types of gases. The issue is how much we contribute to it from a human activity perspective, and then what can be done about it from a process perspective, Chris.
But don't you think the fact that we have these coal power plants belching carbon emissions into the air, do you don't think that is a role?
I think that we've done it better than anybody in the world at burning coal clean in a clean fashion. The innovative and technological advances that we've seen, along with natural gas production and generating electricity, have all contributed to a CO2 footprint that's pre-1994. Again, we have done better than anybody in the world at growing an economy and also being a good steward of our environment. We have nothing to be apologetic about. We're going to operate within the framework of the Clean Air Act to deal with these issues and make sure that we advance clean air, clean water, not just with respect to CO2, but with those key air pollutants under the Ambient Air Quality Standard program.
Okay, so what he did there is a masterclass in goalpost moving. So let me break it down for you. He starts out in the original segment on CNBC. He starts out by saying carbon dioxide is not a primary contributor to climate change. Now, at the time, the CNBC host was sympathetic to that. In fact, I think the CNBC host is even more extreme in his climate science denial than Pruitt is. So he's in friendly environment, and he kind of lets it all hang out and says what he really wants to say, which is carbon dioxide isn't a primary contributor to climate change, which, by the way, is mental. I mean, that's nowhere near true. Not a single serious climate scientist says that. I mean, you want to see how bad carbon dioxide could be? Go ahead, put a plastic bag over your head and breathe into it. Let me know how that works out for you. Exactly. Then he goes on to, well, okay, look, maybe it's a contributor, but the question is, how much do we contribute, and what can we do about it? And his answers to those questions are, how much do we contribute to it? Not that much, that's what he'd say, even if we do contribute a decent amount to it, what can we do about it is the next question, and the answer is really not much. And remember, this is the head of the EPA. This is the guy who's supposed to be directly involved with regulating industry. This is the guy who's supposed to be directly involved with limiting pollution, you know, with limiting our carbon emissions. They're rolling back the clean coal laws, well, clean power plant laws that Obama rolled out. And as a result of that, by the way, you're going to have an increase in deaths. Because, yes, pollution, when you're breathing toxic air for that long, it leads to death. So with the clean power plan, it was like it cut deaths at like thousands of deaths because it limited pollution and limited our carbon emissions. And they're rolling that back. So he goes, how much do we contribute? His answer is not that much. What can we do about it? Not that much. And then you finally move the goalpost to, well, look, you can't hurt industry. We need to find a way to, you know, keep the environment clean and stuff, but you can't hurt industry. So in other words, that the priority is you don't hurt the industry, the profits, the jobs, and even if that means we're driving this thing off a cliff because we're at the point of no return with climate change and the temperature keeps rising, the greenhouse gas effect keeps getting worse, more natural disasters, more sea level rise, what are we going to do? It's just like inevitable. We have to drive the car off the cliff because the industry, jobs, stuff. And then the final goalpost move is when you say, so if you logically respond to all those things, which any reasonable person can, any scientist can, here's how they would rebut it. Oh, carbon dioxide isn't a primary contributor? That is factually wrong. Then when he says, well, how much do we contribute? Not that much. You say, that's not true. That's wrong also. Then when he says, well, what can we do about it? I don't think we could do that much. You say, actually, yeah, we can. We could regulate effectively. Then when he says, look, don't hurt the industry, that would be the worst problem, you say, yeah, but new industries will take its place. Green technology, renewable technology, jobs in the long run will be better off because we have a new deal and a whole new economic boom waiting to happen with renewable technology. So you reject all of his goalposts moving thus far, and then the final pivot he makes is, look, it's just unconstitutional for the government to even be involved in regulating businesses like that. You're overstepping the original guidelines of our government and you're overstepping the Constitution, and the EPA doesn't even have the right or the ability to crack down on these businesses as much as they are. So he gives you all the different lines of bullshit, and the final point he makes is, even if I agree totally that climate change is a crisis and it needs to be addressed and who cares about the loss of old jobs like coal jobs, so on and so forth, even if he agrees to all that, his final position is, don't care, doesn't matter, Constitution prevents us from doing anything anyway. That, my friends, is a masterclass in goalpost moving. Okay, next. According to David Sirota of the International Business Times, Attorney General Jeff Sessions' crackdown on legal weed might be starting. So he says, President Donald Trump's aides have publicly threatened to crack down on states that have legalized marijuana, and the new White House administration may already be taking steps to make good on that pledge, according to an email obtained by International Business Times. The correspondence showed a Justice Department official requesting information about marijuana cases from the state attorney general's office in Colorado, one of seven states where voters have passed ballot measures to legalize the recreational use of cannabis. The email came just after both a top White House official and U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions reiterated the Trump administration's legal opposition to marijuana legalization at the state level. So it's funny because he has all these quotes, Jeff Sessions does, about marijuana, probably his most famous being, good people don't smoke marijuana. So this guy is a drug warrior through and through. He voted to escalate the drug war. He has a terrible record, a backwards record when it comes to the ACLU and people's civil liberties, sides with police all the time. So he was bad. And I warned you, look, this guy's an ideologue. He's a real Kool-Aid drinker. He actually thinks like smoking marijuana makes you a bad person and it shouldn't ever be legal. So now that he's attorney general, I mean, that's like one of the worst positions he can be in because he could do a crackdown on marijuana from there. And some people say, well, no, you know, the wheels are in motion in the other direction. What are you going to do? But what you're missing is just because it's legalized at a state level doesn't mean the federal government just has to sit by idly. In fact, it's the exact opposite. According to our Constitution, federal law overrides state law. It's called the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. So that means the federal government, if they so choose, they could just say, we disagree and we're going to crack down on all the legal weed in the 7 different states. It's done tomorrow. They could just do that. And they might just do that. So, wowzers is all I have to say. And even, apparently Jeff Sessions said to like other Republicans behind closed doors, oh, don't worry, we're not really even going to do a crackdown. And people were, you know, tweeting me those articles, like, oh, see, look. And I looked at them and I thought, look, I don't believe it. Something's coming. I don't know what it's going to be, and I don't know how far they're going to go, but something's coming. Because this guy's a true ideologue, and it doesn't take much to get Trump to flip on something. Just a, you know, somewhat convincing-sounding argument, and he'll go, oh, yeah, okay, fine, go ahead. This is what he did with Big Pharma. He used to say, Big Pharma's getting away with murder. They won't let us negotiate for drug prices. One meeting he had with Big Pharma lobbyists, he came out of there saying, we're not going to renegotiate prices. Big Pharma's getting screwed over by Medicare and the government, and it's not right. You got to leave Big Pharma alone. She flipped. All it took was one smooth-talking lobbyist. So now it could be the same thing with Jeff Sessions. I would brace because it doesn't look good. I think something's coming. I don't know what, but something. Like, for example, they point out in the article, they don't think they're going to go after medical. Wow, so you evolved a little bit. But they might go after legalized marijuana in these various states in a serious way. All right, next. The ACLU has a new petition out that shines a light on a wild problem that we have that nobody talks about. So they explain here, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson plans on doing something that has never been done in this country, execute 8 prisoners in 10 days. The state is rushing to execute these 8 men because Arkansas' supply of controversial execution drug midazolam is going to expire on April 30th. Executions are wrong, and Arkansas's plan is a cruel and unusual killing spree. Arkansas wants to use an execution drug combination with midazolam that's never been used before in the state and that risks making prisoners feel as if they are burning alive from the inside while paralyzed. It's like everybody's worst nightmare. Midazolam has caused botched and painful executions, so Florida and Arizona have stopped using it, and an Ohio judge recently ruled to halt midazolam executions. These facts aren't stopping Hutchinson, so we need to raise our voices together to put pressure on him. Yeah, so I agree. I mean, look, on the issue of criminal justice, I'm actually more moderate than a lot of people in my audience, where they want to like gear the justice system 100% towards rehabilitation. I don't. I like a mix of rehabilitation and punishment. I mean, in some cases, sure, just rehabilitation, but sometimes you need a mix of rehabilitation and punishment. I mean, so maybe I'm a little bit more conservative and punitive in some respects than a lot of the people in my audience. But here's what we both agree on. This is torture, and this is cruel and unusual punishment. And I'm against torture, and I'm against cruel and unusual punishment. You can't use a drug that's been proven to, like, have botched executions tied to it, where people foam at the mouth, it took one guy over 20 minutes to die, and it could be an excruciating pain. On fire while paralyzed, basically, from the inside out. No. You just can't have that. That's insane. That's barbaric. That's even more barbaric than, like, a firing squad is way preferable to that. The gas chamber is way preferable to that. Beheading is way preferable to that. It's over quicker if you just behead them. So we torture them and kill them, and he wants to do 8 in a 10-day period? Where are the good people? Freedom, democracy, human values, liberty, justice, rights. But this is how we act. This is kill 8 people in 10 days and probably torturing them to death. If we can't stop this, how ineffectual is our system? I mean, this is like I couldn't craft a more barbaric thing that anybody's doing. But we're just, maybe we should go through with it and just torture them to death. It's cool. No, that's not cool. I don't care what they did, because if we act like this, what does that say about us? How does that reflect on us and how barbaric and savage we are if we can sit by idly while people are fucking tortured to death? This is on a whole other level of barbarism, and yes, sign that petition, and I hope they don't do it because, man, this reflects horribly on our values and our morality. All right, next. Tourism under Trump. Here we go. The tourism industry in the U.S. is apparently really, really hurting because of President Trump. So according to the Global Business Travel Association, they're predicting a drop of $7 billion in tourism. So they say, I think it's a $250 billion industry overall, but still a $7 billion drop is nothing to scoff at. That's a 6.5%, I think, downturn in international travel to the U.S. Reservations for U.S.-bound flights from Western Europe fell 14% and plunged 38% across the Middle East. I wonder why on that one. And 45% of European business travel professionals say they're less likely to schedule meetings or events in the U.S. So, yeah, I mean, I guess there are some consequences to apart from the obvious, the policies that he's going to implement and the Republicans are going to implement and what they've already implemented, which has been a disaster, there are consequences where people in other countries go, yeah, I think that guy's a dick, and I don't want to go to the country, and I'm going to go ahead and steer clear of it. You know, I was shocked that after one of the mass shootings, who knows which one because they happen so often, but I was contacted from people who listen to the show from Australia. And they told me, like, no, like, you don't get it. People, I know people who have said to me, I was going to plan a trip to America, but I'm not going to go because I'm afraid I'm going to get gunned down in broad daylight. So there were so many mass shootings that happen so often. I mean, they're so high profile. We know them. They happen all the time. That people actually look at the U.S. and go, yeah, that's a risk you take when you go, maybe getting shot. That's how some people think. That it happens so much more often there than other modern nations, although obviously overall statistically it's a very small chance. But the fact that they have over 32,000 gun deaths a year, when in other modern nations is less than 100, people look at that like, yeah, I'm not sure I want to go. That seems like insane. So I was shocked when I learned that, and now you got this on top of it, the people looking at the leader of our country, and they go, yeah, seems like an unhinged buffoon, not sure I want to go there. Isn't that just sad, man? I mean, look, there's a lot of other things the U.S. does that don't get enough attention and do deserve the attention that should have made people go, that's messed up, whether it be destabilizing third world governments and putting in our own fascist puppets to serve our corporations, whether it's torture and extrajudicial prisons or illegal wars, all that, man. But it's like, so you had all that, and now the cherry on top was, and put in a thin-skinned reality star buffoon who's obviously authoritarian, and then people will finally go, pump my brakes. $7 billion drop in tourism is what's predicted. Nuts. Okay, let's finish up here. We got two more. I want to lighten it up, and then we'll end on a serious one. So there's a world-renowned plastic surgeon in China named Dr. Guo Xuzong, and he created an ear out of a guy's arm and then connected it to its head, to his head. Yeah. That's insane. I don't even know what to say about this story other than, wow. So this is, you know, they like stretched out the skin on his arm and then did something else, and it's almost like voodoo. This is like wizardry and magic to me. I mean, obviously it's not, it's science. But that's kind of the point I wanted to make, is this is, it's almost like science is at a point where it's just, it appears like magic. Like, it looks like magic. Like, oh, you lost your ear in some horrible accident, and, well, don't worry about that. We'll just create an ear out of your arm and then reattach it. They say the surgery took an hour, which I'm amazed. I would think it's going to take way longer than that. They said they reattach it. They got the blood flowing to it. I'm amazed that it's, like, fully functional, but that there, it's what it is. So, yeah, hashtag science for the win, because this is something that, well, can you imagine going back, traveling to, like, the year 1600 and talking to somebody? Say, yeah, no, don't worry. I mean, there's going to come a time where we can regrow limbs. And just, it is what it is. An ear, really, you know, intricate, ornate, kind of complex thing Yeah, we'll just come up with it. And then there was another story recently. They created a heart out of a spinach leaf. Oh, God damn. Like, what are you – what? I don't even get this. Like, it doesn't even click in my head. I barely get the concepts, never mind seeing it actually empirically done. So science for the win. I love this. It makes me feel fuzzy and happy. And I hope we see a lot more of it in the future. Okay, final story of the day. The criminal president in the Philippines is at it again. RT reports here, President Rodrigo Duterte has once again slammed the critics of his controversial war on drugs approach, saying those who recommend rehabilitation and substitute treatment should visit him personally in the Philippines because he wants to, quote, slap them. Come here and we will talk because I want to slap you, Duterte said in a speech late Friday, blasting those who advise him to abandon his extreme anti-drug policy and instead build clinics around like in other countries and give shabu, cocaine, and heroin like in Holland. I don't know what shabu is. Earlier this week, Duterte called the European Union politicians sons of bitches for proposing to him such a government-sponsored idiotic exercise instead of arresting and putting drug dealers in prison. The confrontation between Manila and Brussels exacerbated mid-March after EU lawmakers adopted a resolution condemning the many extrajudicial killings allegedly taking place in the Philippines. In response, Duterte told the EU not to interfere with Philippines affairs, threatening to, quote, hang his critics. I love the irony there. Well, I'm totally reasonable. I don't know what you're talking about. Nothing bad's happening here. And if you disagree, I'm going to hang you. Kind of proving their point. He says, I will just be happy to hang you. If I have the preference, I'll hang all of you, Duterte said in March. The recent rhetoric by Duterte prompted the European Union on Monday to summon the Philippines envoy for an explanation. Duterte's attitude toward the nation's narcotics problem has been ruthless, with human rights organizations estimating that more than 8,000 people have been killed in the police crackdown on drug dealers and abusers since June 2016. The president's anti-drug rhetoric has been equally severe in public addresses, where Duterte has previously said he would be, quote, happy to slaughter drug addicts and hang criminals like curtains. So, look, this is no joke, and that number keeps ticking up. They're saying over 8,000 people have been killed in what is just a flat-out eradication, and almost like a genocide of drug users. That's what it is. I mean, he said repeatedly, kill them. Yeah, kill them, slaughter them. I'd have their family members kill them, but I don't think they're strong enough to do it, so I want you to kill them. The police, if you do it, nobody's going to crack down on you. Nobody's going to arrest you. If you kill a drug addict in the street, kill him. I'm not kidding. This is what he's been saying. This is what's been happening. And then when the international media is like, hey, man, you should maybe stop. Like, oh, I'll hang you too. I'm like, don't be an idiot. You're an idiot. They're idiots. You're killing people for drug use. And the cherry on top, we covered this story a while ago. Guess who had a prescription for fentanyl from his doctor? Fentanyl. Freaking horse tranquilizer that is the most powerful opiate of all of them. Fentanyl, 100 times more powerful than morphine. Rodrigo Duterte would get prescriptions from his doctor. How much you want to bet he's still on it? This is exactly like the Republicans who are anti-gay, but then they call blowing some dude in a New Jersey turnpike bathroom. Rodrigo Duterte says, the drugs are bad, drugs are bad, I'm going to kill all the drug users. You should kill all the drug users, and that's what you...
Yeah, it feels so good, give me more drugs and give me more fentanyl.
He's a bad guy, man, and he's super unhinged. I don't know what the answer is moving forward. I don't know what to do, but this is a crisis when you have the eradication of drug users. 8,000 being killed. They have no rights. They're just in permanent underclass, and they're literally being slaughtered. I don't know what the answer is, but I feel like it needs to be more than what's being done now. Mild criticism from the international community. It doesn't seem to be working. So the clock's on this problem, but it gets almost no international attention, and it's one of the most amazing stories that's happening today. Okay. I'm out of time, guys. I love you. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Everybody enjoy the rest of your day. Mwah. Peace.